off the ball.
7 days a week.
On News Talk 106 to 108.
All right, hello the Drury Buildings. Yeah, not bad, not bad at all. What about a cheer for Brian O'Driscoll? And Fergus McFadden? And Owen Redden? You're all very welcome along here tonight. We're here with Vodafone, official sponsor of the Irish rugby team. Lads, you are welcome, and I have to say I'm pretty excited about the fact that the Six Nations is finally here. We talk nonsense about it for 11 months of the year and then wait around for the next one to come, and it's here.
Yeah, it's here, and we're in great shape, so reason to be excited.
And also reason to be terrified. We're in great shape. It doesn't really sit very well with the Irish.
It does now. It does more so. I think off the back of that November, you know, first time winning down in South Africa, Joe Schmidt's our coach, our strength and depth is brilliant. Even the South Africans now want to play for us. It's all, you know, it's all working out okay.
Fergus, are you a bit sickened that you're like here talking nonsense to us instead of actually in camp getting ready for this game?
Yeah, of course, of course. And I'm sure, listen, this part of the year is maybe a couple of the games are the one side of it where Brian and Owen would miss as well. But for me, as still a current player, you know, this injury has been really frustrating for me. One, because, you know, I wasn't in the shop window to be selected for the extended squad for the Six Nations, but two, because, you know, Leinster have been going so well since Stuart arrived, and my first game, unfortunately, I picked up this injury. It was a nasty kind of tendon tear to my quad. So, you know, as we talked just beforehand, it's been going on 17 weeks next week, but I'll be back in the frame for the Treviso game. So please, God, just be back on the field now.
Yeah, this might be the first recorded instance in history of anybody being excited to play against Treviso. and also, it's not like everybody who's come in for you hasn't been running in hat-tricks from inside their own 22, so...
Yeah, no, it's been grand watching the wingers score four or five tries a game. No, but listen, I mean... The rugby that Leinster are playing at the moment is back to the good old days, but the good old days with really good defensive structure involved, and it's exciting. And without getting too carried away, I think between Munster and Leinster going into those knockout stages, you know, either team could go all the way if with a bit of luck. So you know, please God, I'll just be back in the frame for some of that.
Owen, you're acclimatizing to civilian life, or are you still a bit sickened that you're not involved?
Yeah, no, acclimatizing. It's looking forward to tomorrow. Should be a big day, and pity we don't see Ferg out there now. Yeah, but I think it should be a massive day for the Six Nations. I think everyone's going to want to throw the ball around a bit. You're going to see a lot of attacking rugby, and the lads might have contrary beliefs to me, but I think the bonus point system will be great for the tournament.
Maybe we should just get into that now that you've brought it up, because you're a believer that the bonus point system will actually change the thinking of the coaches, and that we might see selection go the way of the more creative player than the defensive player, and that this mindset will actually seep into the teams.
Yeah, I think it's probably, that's definitely going to happen, you know, at some stage, whether it starts now or in the future. When coaches sit down, they do have to be mindful of scoring more tries, and that might lead you to pick a more attacking team. Now, you know, most times people playing international rugby have got everything anyway, so that doesn't really come down to it. But I do think that tomorrow, like, Ireland will face a different Scotland than they would have 12 months ago. I think they're going to be dangerous. They're going to really have a go from deep, and they've got players who can score from deep. So, on the other hand... you know, we have that as well, so I think it's going to be a great game. But I do think we'll have defensively, we'll definitely be tested tomorrow. We're very early on in the competition.
You think he's talking nonsense about the bonus point, Brian?
Yeah, I didn't see any need to change it. If they were going to change it, I wouldn't have changed it off the back of the last two finishes. And the final day, there was so much excitement.
Yeah.
The last couple of years, maybe 3-4 years ago, if they introduced the idea, I might have been more open to it. But I just don't like the idea. If you look at Italy's record, the longer they go in the competition, the more fall off they tend to have. So it's going to, when you come up against them, the teams that have them in rounds 4 and 5 are most likely going to get bonus points. Granted, it is a new, it's a new Italy. Conor O'Shea, Brendan Venter at defence will have them far more organised. But even still, they have been the whipping boys of the competition more than not over the last 10, 12 years. So I just didn't see any need to change it. It's worked in Europe, worked in some other competitions, but the Five Nations and Six Nations has always been about simplicity and back to basics, and I don't see why they needed to change it up.
Yeah, Ferg, as a player, does it change your mindset at all, knowing there's a bonus point on offer?
I suppose it does, but, you know, under Joe, all you're thinking about is your job role, really, from the stuff that he's walked you through during the week. So I don't really think it'll change much from a player's perspective under Joe. But going into certain games, Joe will definitely approach games, you know, if we have to get 5 points out of or 10 points out of our last two games to be in with the sniff of winning or getting, being in the mix for it to win the championship, then obviously Joe will approach those games differently. But I would agree with Brian as opposed to Redzer. I think the last 2 years, you look at the Six Nations and how exciting the final day has been. You know, I don't see the reason to bring this ruling in place, but who knows? We'll see.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about our record against Scotland. And when we were kids growing up, we used to go to Murrayfield and get absolutely annihilated. And they would just physically... they would kill us at Rooks. They would just maul us off the pitch. And it was kind of this procession every year where you went there. Apparently, Eddie O'Sullivan brought you guys over a day early one year to kind of have a wander around the city and go, look, there's nothing creepy about this place. It's just another place to go and play rugby.
I can't remember that specifically happening. But, I think we didn't. Certainly the teams that I was involved in the early 2000s, we didn't feel that expectation of going over and that we're going to be on the receiving end of a thumping. Yes, that might have historically been the case throughout the 90s, but we went over with fresh positivity. We had a lot of guys that had done very well at underage levels, and that was the norm. Winning away was the norm, and they'd beaten Scotland at schoolboy and 21 level regularly. So why should that not equate into the senior team?
So that actually gave you confidence, having done that at underage level. That matters.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, that said, was it 2001 was my first game in Murrayfield, and we got absolutely thumped by them in the refixture of the foot and mouth.
Yeah.
But then that was only one of two losses over there since the inception of the Six Nations. So we've got a very good record. And it's going to be a very, very tough game tomorrow. I think that the loss of Johnny Sexton at 10 is huge. And the Scots have been talking a great game all week. They're not shy in confidence for a side that, you know, it hasn't quite delivered yet. They might have the talent, but I don't think they've quite delivered for the chat that's been coming out of there.
Yeah. That sense of playing against the team, obviously we've done quite well against the Scottish club size. Does that matter as well when you're heading into a game like this, that you know your direct opponent and you've played them in the game and you've actually beaten them quite well recently enough?
Yeah, I suppose so, but we've probably done better on... a test level than a club level against them over the past few years. I mean, Glasgow have been an absolute thorn in Leinster's side. I know we beat them in semi-final and final in the Pro 12 stages, but you know, they've been one team we've really struggled to beat on plenty of occasions throughout the domestic season in the Pro 12. And you know, as you see, they're through to the quarterfinals now. But what's interesting about Scotland, I find at the moment, is that a lot of chat is that, you know, Glasgow are on such a positive run, and a lot of their players are going into the Scottish side, but they're being coached in that situation by Gregor Townsend, and I rate Vern Cotter as a coach. I think he's a really good coach, but he's a very different coach to Gregor Townsend. So I think that Scotland's style of play, I know he's saying they'll throw it around and all the rest, but I think it will differ from the likes of a Glasgow, and certainly the strike plays that Gregor brings in. I think he's one of the best coaches around at the moment, and I think I just don't know if it'll transfer as much onto for the Scottish national side as it has for the clubs.
How would you characterise Cotter? What will he do that's slightly different to that?
I think the way Joe talked about him, he just likes to really beat teams up physically. I mean, that's what he brought that into Claremont's makeup, and they've been doing that since he left, very much so under John O'Gibbs. But he looked to beat us up front, but I just don't see how they can do that when our pack is. You know, it is that much stronger than theirs. I think they've got some outstanding players, the two Gray brothers, Wilson, very good back rower, but our scrum is so strong at the moment. We're animalising South Africa at times down there in one of the toughest places in the world to go and scrummage. Our scrum against New Zealand was incredible. I just think it's going to be a wet day tomorrow in Murrayfield, and I think we're going to be too strong in that area over the course of 80 minutes.
Yeah, it's funny that they've gone for such an inexperienced front row. I'm here looking at the three of you going, I'm going to talk front row now for a second. Not too long, lads. Not a lot of caps in that front row.
No, it's not. They got, I think, the youngest player in the tournament is Fagerson, and Dell is the other. He's a 24-year-old. But, like, I mean... See, Jack and Tyke Furlong are both young, but they're massively experienced. Like, they've been involved in Jack has been involved in two winning Six Nations sides. They were both down in South Africa. They were both at the last World Cup. They both beat Australia and New Zealand over the course of November. Like, these guys are being brought, you know, hopefully it has Jack and Ty go well tomorrow, but the two Scottish guys are coming up against a whole different animal in the front row with Rory Best as well in the middle tomorrow, and I just think that we're going to get a huge foothold in the game in that area tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think on top of that, and it's not my area of expertise, but I don't think either of the Greys are renowned significant scrummagers too. I don't think people laud them as being, you know, being the strongest part of their game. Obviously, they're incredibly efficient at line-out time. Johnny Gray is very good at the park, has missed hardly any tackles in the
10 in his entire career, somebody said.
Yeah, like it's ridiculous. So his completion rate is exceptional, but I do think, I agree with Ferg, I think we have a really powerful scrum from a few years ago where teams used to come at us. I think now, you know, others will be ruining knock-ons all the more because they know they're going to have to scrum against us.
Yeah, so maybe a wet day actually doesn't hurt us in any way. Like, okay, grand, if it's dry, we'll beat you, but if it's wet, then we're going to scrum you off the park.
Yeah, well, wet days, you just have to have your basics right. You're not going to be able to try any elaborate plays, so you just have to get your fundamental skill set working for you and just grind teams down by building performance on defence and set piece and making the referee make decisions about, you know, about giving penalties away for players infringing and keep the scoreboard ticking over. You're not going to get, on wet days, you're going to get very few 4-point bonus points or 4-try bonuses. So, you know, tomorrow will be just about getting a straight win.
Yeah. What's your assessment of how this game is going to go? Thinking about it in the week, what do you...
Yeah, I think I agree with Brian in terms of being away in Murrayfield in your first game. You know, bonus points are not... You know, you have to win the game first. I think it does change things about what Scotland have to do in terms of their aims for the competition. They need to score tries if they can and put themselves in a position to win the game and potentially go and try and get a bonus point, you know, because that's the nature of the competition now. So I think they've got, like, very, very good strike players and they're going to play from a bit deeper, and that does bring them into the game a lot more. You know, like, guys like Stuart Hogg are very effective running from their own 22, and when they get into your 22, you know, sometimes you've got more guys in the line, it's easier to deal with them. So I think those guys are serious broken field runners, and you know, that'll be a big challenge for us tomorrow. I think we've got you know, obviously our defence with Andy Farrell is obviously very, very, very good and is very aggressive, and, you know, hopefully that could actually, you know, on a wet day lead to something positive for us, and we might pick up a try or two, you know, when Scotland have the ball. I do think it's going to be very tricky. I think it's Scotland in the first game are always very, very good. They're, no matter who they play, usually first up, they keep it tight and are the scoreline tight, and it could go either way. And, you know, the fans, everyone, there's serious positivity. And
What's that like to play in? Sorry.
Sorry, no, on that point, I think Redzer's the guy that probably came up with the idea of scoring tries off your defence. You know, it was his tagline. Am I right, Reds? That
it was probably your go-to
line about, you know, trying to force the opposition to make mistakes, and it's definitely something that I think Andy Farrell looks at getting the Irish team using the defence as a weapon, as an attacking weapon.
Where did you pick that up?
Yeah, that would have been Wasps. I suppose we'd have defended probably, you know, in a similar vein to the way most teams are now.
Sean Edwards?
Yeah, Sean Edwards, yeah, in 2005. And they would have been doing it for 2 years. So they were, you know, a long way ahead of the game. And if I'm being honest, you know, it, having done it at that point, it did feel right and felt very comfortable. And you know, I think most teams have gone there and will end up there. Like, New Zealand were probably one of the last teams to start doing it, and they're doing it now, and think... It does make it harder to play rugby, you know. It's so you've a real mix now of you've got bonus points coming in, but you've got, you know, more aggressive defences, better organised defences that dare you to kick the ball a little bit more, and you've got guys like Rob or Stuart Hogg picking up loose kicks and being able to run back. So I think you know, it is proven to be, it's probably a necessity actually from my point of view with the bonus points, with the way the defences were going. Because they're becoming so strong, you know, like, you will see a lot of more, like, Wales have been doing it for years, obviously. Ireland are doing it now. England are very, very much, very, very strong.
When people are watching at home, what are they looking for to know that this is happening?
You'll think people are offside all the time. You'll just think, oh my God, how are they up so fast? And why doesn't Paddy Jackson have any time? And how is he nearly blocking him down? You'll find yourself screaming at the TV, they're offside. That's basically it.
Playing their wingers higher as well. Mm. You know, if you see if their wingers aren't on a half, when they're around the middle of the park, you'll know that they're kind of playing that system. Yeah. England have been doing it for a while, and their wingers are also expected to then cover that space in behind and read the body language early when the ball's...
But there's more of a role then on the scrum half too, to play in the backfield with the full back, right?
Mm. Yeah, as like two in the backfield as opposed to three with the pendulum. So the three with the pendulum would be the two wingers and a half with the full back going over and across, whereas with this aggressive system like Redzer was talking about, you've got the wingers up there and then you've got the 9 and the 15, you know, covering that space in behind.
Which is interesting because Conor Murray as a defensive scrum half must be the best in the world. He's exceptional about reading and understanding how to plug the hole. During the South African game when CJ Stander got sent off, the first test, Conor Murray was the difference. He plugged the hole, really smart defending. So it's actually counter to his intuition of trying to get up there and make impacts and close off space of him having to defend in the backfield. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic.
Well, you're kind of taking that out of his game, but also I guess...
Well, there's flexibility there as well. I think like if you plug, you know, basically the whole system is about having more people in the front line. So in the olden days, you'd have 3 in the backfield, 11 in the front line and you're 9 in behind, okay? Now you've basically 2 in the backfield and 13 in the front line. So you've 2 more in the front line, and that's basically what it all comes down to. And who those people are, yeah, the scrum half does have a role to cover back or go forward and fill in where he's needed. And as Brian said, more often than before, he is in the backfield these days, you know? But I think it does make it harder to attack. But now the powers that be are making it more important to attack, so it does create a good dynamic for the game.
So whose role, Redzer, is it to now cover the chip line? Because we know Finn Russell is someone that goes to the chip an awful lot because of that rush defence.
Yeah.
He'll preempt it and have his outside backs charging those little dinks. They can be he can hook them inside over rooks. He's got a brilliant array of little kicking skills. Yeah. So who covers that place?
Yeah, and it's probably an interesting point because it probably gets harder and harder the higher level you play because of people like Finn Russell. I think the further up the pitch you go, the more it could be your 13 who's in the line showing up and then having to get back and cover, or maybe the 12 on the other side who's stopped on the blind side, and then as you squeeze up the pitch towards the halfway line, the 9 is going to have to be able to close that space really quickly, you know, and then when he gets closer to his own line, he's probably in the line as well. When he won at the back, and then the fullback's got to cover the whole lot of it, you know. So thinking as you move up the pitch, you know, if someone in the line's got to, so you get closer to the say Scotland's try line, someone in our line is going to have to cover that. As you get further back, you know, we'll have someone back there to cover it.
Is this all from... Well, this was all happening last year while you were still playing? This isn't just you watching the last couple of months?
Yeah, this isn't specific to Ireland at all. Like, this is...
The game.
You know, Saracens have probably been doing this as at a club level, you know, for a long time now and probably physically stood up to teams that other teams didn't, you know. And, you know, regardless of what size you are, if there's a big guy running at you, you're better off running at him. You know, you're standing still and waiting to get hit. You know, trust me, it's not the best tactic. And, you know, things like offloads and stuff, if I'm standing still and a guy runs at me, there's a high chance he's going to get an offload. Whereas if I'm running at him as he catches the ball, he's not going to get be offloading the ball. So this isn't really specific to Ireland, what I'm talking about. It's just a general system, whereas before, you know, as we spoke about, you have 3 guys back or 2.5 back and people moving up and out and giving people time to play. You know, it's just it's part of a global system. Ireland would have even more detail and more intricacies around that.
Yeah. For the difference this season when Stuart Lancaster has brought a system to Leinster, is it fairly similar to what Ireland are doing? Like
that, what Redzer talked about there about the 9 and the 15 you were mentioning is pretty much what he's brought in. The wingers playing high. But you see, the wingers are playing high, but they also have to be accountable for the space. The space isn't just the 15 in behind. Like, they're accountable to read the 10's body language. You know, so if the 10 is getting, he looks like he's passing, his eyes are that way, but all of a sudden he changes. Like, the winger has to be able to, he can't just come up and expect the fullback to cover that. So the space in behind, you're still accountable for, but you're presenting a front line. But the other thing is that Redzer was talking about having 13 players in the front line. It's all well and good having 13 players in the front line. Plenty of teams can do that, but and the likes of Andy Farrell and Stuart Lancaster bring in systems where you've got the correct spacing with those 13, where it literally feels like there isn't even two meters either side of that 13 players, because their spacing is perfect throughout the field. You know, and it's not just spacing. You know, you're going 3 meters out. You're
how do you fix that though? How do you practice that? Because it's in the middle of a game. Special awareness.
Your third defender from the ruck is basically, he's lined up with the first attacker, whether that be a pot of forwards coming at him or the 10 collecting the ball. So if he's starting on, if your fifth guy from the ruck is starting on the 10, your system's wrong. You know, you've got to get that spacing correct right away across the field. And as Reds have said, Saracens have been doing it over the past few seasons, and they're not the biggest. You know, they're not bigger than Claremont. They're not more powerful than Claremont, but they have that side to their game where their defence has turned into a form of attack, and so many of their tries, the likes of Chris Ashton, that are not scoring tries, they're scoring tries off turnovers because their defence is creating them. They're running through the holes, going through there. It's huge, and you know, hopefully Ireland can implement that this Six Nations.
Just going back a little bit on a point that Ferg made about Leinster having quite a similar defence to Ireland, I think the difference where Ireland's defence has appeared to be a little bit better than Leinster's, and I covered a lot of the games in the European Cup, and I think Adam Byrne and Rory O'Loughlin have done brilliantly, but I think at times they've shown a little bit naivety of not understanding what was going to happen with the 10. I think that's where a wealth of experience like himself, guys that have been there, Dave Kearney, even out a long time, the more you play, the more you're able to read what a 10 is going to do.
Yeah.
And I think the grass cover from Leinster hasn't nearly been as good as Ireland. I think when you've got Sebo and Earlsey on the wing, they're going to be able to sense it just a fraction earlier and cover that grass cover much better.
Are Munster doing the same stuff as well, so that when the lads come in from Munster, they're like, okay, I know what we're doing, it's fairly similar? Or like, are you allowed to have a totally different defensive system if you're a Munster?
Yeah, of course. But I think they're probably taking an awful lot of what's come from Ireland, the positivity. Jack Neighbour, is it Jack?
Yeah.
Has obviously done a phenomenal job. He's got his own version of that system, but they're all quite alike now. It's about that really aggressive line speed, trying to align up against someone, get that third defender against the first ball carrier, and then everyone else getting off the line for three or four paces, and then understanding who their man is going to be. It's not worrying about, you know, specifics as to who it is. That's going to lose you a second. First of all, get yourself off the line, show an aggressive line, and then make the first receiver think, oh my God, I've got massive aggression here, I've got to go back inside.
It's very important from a club point of view, because you know, you spend 8 weeks with Ireland now, and then you drop back into the biggest game of the season for your province.
Yeah.
Within 2 weeks. So, you know, standing back and saying should we defend in a similar vein to Ireland or not is really, you know, a pretty obvious question. You know,
you've no choice.
You do. You know, if you back yourself to be able to coach a system back in 2 weeks. Now, I think, you know, in Ireland, actually, you've had a funny turn of events where Connacht have actually been doing this. Munster have started now since the summer, and Leinster doing as well. You know, Les was always a fan of getting off the line quick as well, so you're probably in a situation now where they all are doing that, but that wasn't the case previously. You know, in previous Six Nations, we wouldn't have defended like that, and then we'd have gone back to Leinster and defended differently, and it just, you know, in the biggest game of the year...
A bit of a head wreck?
Well, it's not, but you talk about inches, you know what I mean? You talk about doing your passing or doing your tackling, doing your fitness for that inch, and then you've a system that you've got to learn back in 2 weeks. You can understand how important that would be for a team, you know? I think...
Is it an accident that we now have that, or is that actually kind of how they've engineered
well,
it,
everyone
situation?
Is like, you know, everyone has their own... Like it's probably more a progression, and that people have seen that it's a good way of defending. And we've got good coaches around the country, like probably the best in any country around at the moment. And I mean, right from the top all the way through to the provinces. Like, so they all kind of generally graduate towards that anyway, because they know it's a good thing to do, you know. So it's probably not an accident, because they know what they're doing. But I think they've done it independently. There's definitely no chat about you do have to defend this way or anything.
But Joe's defensive system from Leinster to now is vastly different, right? Yeah. So he would have been, you might have come from a really aggressive place at Ireland,
yeah,
back to a more passive defensive system under Joe Schmidt. And since Andy Farrell's come in, he's completely revolutionised the defence, right?
Yeah, I think he has. And I think he, you know, when he, you know, if you meet Andy Farrell once, you kind of know, you know, you take him at what he says. You know, there's no bringing Andy in and asking him to coach a different way. And I think, you know, it showed great confidence from Joe that, you know, he could bring someone like that in and let him, you know, because Joe likes to be in charge of everything. You know, I think he'd say that himself. And I think being able to let someone else do that and have the, albeit, you know, an international coach with a very, very good proven track record. So maybe it wasn't such a big leap of faith, but I think, you know, they put together a really good team there.
I think maybe that's kind of a point that needs to be just teased out a bit. We are saying that he had the wherewithal and self-awareness to go, something failed for me, I need to go out, get something in the marketplace that's going to improve me and not have the ego to say, no, I'm not doing that. Oh, I like a little bit of that, but I'm not doing it all. Do you know, it's like...
Yeah, I think he swallowed his pride a small bit. Yeah, you know, there was definitely a few frailties from that Argentinian game. They really put us to the sword a few times. There could have been more tries in that quarterfinal game.
Yeah.
Other than great scramble defence. So I think it was a big call, him going and sourcing out Andy Farrell.
A really good sign about him, though, that he's actually learning immediately from the losses, right?
Good coaches are always learning. They're always willing to try and improve and modify things. I actually... met Eddie Jones at a function. I sat beside him last year.
Did you punch him?
And
he changed his story on that, by the way. Did everybody see this? It was like, oh, I was shaving the shower, and there was always a training ground accident. Like, oh, if you're going to start telling porkies, you better maintain the same porky the whole way through, right?
That was like Gats breaking his two ankles cleaning his windows at home in New Zealand. But Eddie, in fairness to him, had just won the Grand Slam, just come back from a whitewash of against Australia, and he was all questions about what made Joe Smith so good.
Yeah.
So there, you know, I think the good coaches get over the egotistical part of really wanting to improving themselves and then subsequently improving their teams.
Yeah, fair enough.
Was Brian suggesting he broke Warren's ankle? <was he? laughs>
It was pre the Lions tour. Oh, no.
They're all friends now, though, right?
Best of buds.
Okay, a load of text coming through. Lads, it's a Redden crowd down there. He definitely got the biggest cheers. Must be a Limerick element in the audience. Yeah,
just very, very intelligent audience tonight.
That's from Steve listening in Adair. A text on the bonus points. The problem is that it normally takes the last weekend for the shackles to come off, so maybe the bonus points will bring the excitement to all five games, says Mike and Kerry. There's a sense that after the World Cup, the rugby was a bit grim because the teams were so knackered, and there was a massive outcry about how the Six Nations is crap. The games were 10-8 or 8-9 or whatever it was. And so immediately there's a reaction to that, as opposed to the sample size of a couple of years and actually thinking, well, you know, if we're going to change something so fundamentally, let's look at a 10-year period and see if the scoring was right or wrong. But it's done now, so I guess that's it.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the problem is. You know, like, you're going to have to play more rugby now. And that's a fact. I agree with Brian. He made a point that it's probably not made the competition fairer because you've different teams at home. And I agree with that. I agree that it's not necessarily a fairer competition now. But I think we're all going to get better. We're all going to have to try harder to play more. And, you know, that's going to be good for the game.
Okay. Somebody else agrees with you. Joe in Cork says, the bonus point idea is great. The last two championship finishes have been great, but the four rounds before that have been drab enough. It showed in the World Cup last year, free-flowing attacking rugby is the way to go. Nigel and Louth says, as a fellow scrum half, what does Owen think about the level of protection afforded to Connor around the rooks? Are the Scottish going to try and take his leg off?
Yeah, I thought that was pretty bad way of trying to use the laws within the laws to try and hurt someone. You know, I think... I'm pretty sure, I doubt it would happen again if Glasgow even played, to be honest. I think, you know, it's probably kind of thing that you decide during the week. Although Glasgow have done it a few times, you know, maybe because they've never hurt anyone, they've continued on. You kind of hope they're not actually trying to blow someone's knee out, but you can see, you know, anyone who doesn't need, you don't need to be a physio to say that that's going to actually be serious damage. And unfortunately, there's not much you can do as an Irish player to protect them because they're coming from behind them, you know. And if you put guys behind you to block you, then the ball's going to get blocked down, you know. So you got to put the guy in front of you to help you kick the ball. And I think it leaves you open from behind. And, you know, I wouldn't think you'll see it tomorrow. I think it was just a bad play in the rules of the game, really.
Is there any way to protect a standing leg while someone's kicking? Is it like, can you make a specific rule for it?
I don't know. You can do what Connor did, which was just jump in the air last second, which saved them a few times, you know. Yeah. I don't know, like, yeah, maybe you can make a rule to it to that effect, but it's tricky, you know.
Maybe you have to block down the actual kicking leg. Like, I don't see why he would, and like, unless he's trying to make him kick the ball badly, there's no reason to go to the person's plant leg anyway, because you're not going to affect the trajectory of the ball. Whereas, you know, if the person is making a commitment to go and just block the ball with their hands, the actual kicking leg, then actually, I think what happened in that game is, you'd like to think that the Glasgow players weren't doing that purposely, because that you know, that's the bottom of the barrel type of carry on, really. I agree with Reds, or I can't see it happening tomorrow, really.
Okay. Having retired, do the two owl lads on the panel, brackets Brian and Owen, miss being able to eat millions of carbs like Fergus? What's the worst part about being retired?
Look, I've met Redzer for lunch on Wednesday. I probably wouldn't have bothered if I'd known I was doing this with him. But I found out about his grueling training routine, though he's working like 70-hour weeks. So he's still eating as many carbs as he wants. He looks as though he could up tomorrow and still do a job.
A late-season comeback here for Owen Redden. We're breaking
one more year?
Yeah, well... I'm a member of Old Crescent, and they played Thomond in Thomond there a few weeks ago, which might have been an attractive prospect when I was younger, but certainly wasn't something I was going to think about now.
That's a lie. You're thinking about it. You brought it up on prompt.
Well, I went home to my wife and I said, "Cheepers, I could play for Crescent against Thomond there," and like expecting her to say, "You mad?" And she said, "We're in Limerick that day anyway." And I was like, "Oh God." You're supposed to be helping me here, say no.
We were off when we were chatting off air there just before the show started. Ferg was talking us through some of the new fitness drills that are going on, and Redzer said, "Do you know what I miss most about the game is that really sick feeling after really torturing yourself in one of those fitness sessions. There's something wrong with your head if that's what you're really..."
I don't know what to say, yeah.
It's true, though.
It is true. I don't miss the games as much. I was even saying it to Brian the other day. I think... in a bizarre way, you put yourself under I certainly would have put myself under a lot of pressure playing in the last few years. You know, you're trying to, I suppose people see you as older and they're putting you in on the bench here. You'll be good in the last 20 minutes. But I would never have spent a day playing thinking that, you know, and I would never wanted to spend a day playing where I didn't think I was actually trying to play for what was the highest possible thing that season. And when you pull the pin on that, and that would have gone right through the season, no matter which game you play, you know, whether it be, you mentioned Treviso away, or you know, 10 minutes against Scotland at home, there's the pressure that if you don't perform in these 60, 80 minutes, that big thing is gone, and you're so close to the line all the time as you get older, that I probably put myself under a lot of pressure. I think as soon as I pulled the pin on that, and was like, I had something else that I really wanted to do, that kind of emerged later in the year, and I was motivated by something else, that it just, once it was gone, it was like...
Yeah, because you pulled the pin really quickly. It was like middle of the South African tour, the announcement comes out, Owen Redden's retiring immediately. I was like, normally people have like a year or two of wandering around.
Idiot.
Or dragging it out for a year or two.
That was it.
I actually wanted to play for one more, but I couldn't handle the humiliation of another one.
Yeah, Brian's the lesson on what not to do, I think.
Did you know before the South African tour that was it, and you were kind of waiting to tell
everybody? I honestly was thinking about playing on, and then I got the opportunity that I'm in now, and you know, I thought, that's crazy, you'd play on, you wouldn't take that. And then I kind of went to sleep and was thinking, actually, something was nagging at me that I didn't want to let this other thing go, which just kept on going over my head, and in the end, that's what I did. I took
the next day, it was that quick?
No, sorry, over weeks, right, or days. Yeah, it might have taken me 2 or 3 weeks to come to the decision. But I thought, you know, one was the finish of something and one was the start of something, you know, and I went for the start of something.
Yeah, well, fair enough. Okay, we're live here from the best seat in the house at Drury Buildings, Dublin, with Vodafone, official sponsor of the Irish rugby team. And Nathan has a question from the crowd.
Yeah, I'm here with our Roisin. Roisin is from Roscommon. She is worried that the lads will not give an honest answer to this question. I've assured her they will.
Hi guys, how are you? I just heard Ronan O'Gara a few years ago talk about Keith Earls, and at the time he said Keith was absolutely magical in training, but just this wasn't being translated onto the pitch. Over the years, would you have come across any guys who you would say, okay, yeah, they're good on the pitch, but they're not reaching their full potential, what we see them doing in training?
Question.
That sounds like an answer for a current player.
You might lose.
How?
You might lose friends.
Quinny.
Quinny was always really good in training, and then when he played, no, I'm joking.
There are some players
you can say yourself if you want.
There are some players that might jump to mind, but obviously not going to mention any names. The one thing about it is, you see, in a lot of our training, during the week. So you're going through set moves before a big game, and you're running through set moves where there's like two hand touch, and there's, you know, you're basically playing tag without the tags, kind of, and the skills can look silky and the steps can look great. But when you get to Saturday, when the shackles are off and it's full contact, there's some guys that aren't as, they can't throw the 30-yard passes as well as some other guys, but they can, you know, they can rook two, three guys out at a time, or they're just good at simplistic physical stuff. And I think that's where it relates back into the game. People saying, oh, they're good, we're very good trainers and not good players, and that's just what I think.
From that, I think you know what day of the week Ferg used to show up.
I suppose I'm probably thinking from my own personal point of view, I played a lot of Gaelic football and I wasn't class in training or anything, but I never really performed in front of a big crowd, which happened probably once a year as a lady footballer. So I guess from another point of view, is there anyone you'd say is a real big match performer?
I think there's certain players that, excuse me, that love training, and some players love playing. Yeah, Reds are loved at all. For me, training was a means to an end. I'd have played two games. If my body was up to it, I'd have played two games a week. All the lifting weights and all the fitness sessions, they were a necessary evil. But the be-all and end-all was playing big games. And you can only really answer that for yourself. There's other guys, I think there was a thread a few years ago in the academy that guys loved just being part of an academy, of being gym rats and, you know, posting really impressive scores up on the whiteboard for everyone to see, getting pats on the back. Then they go out and their skill set was appalling and they were terrible when they managed to play for Leinster A or for their clubs. So I think that there's been a shift in that, and we've gone back to a very much, particularly in Leinster, they've gone back to a ball focus and a skill level, and it's about rugby players being athletes rather than the other way around.
I think two examples, though, without genuinely today saying just because the lads are here, but two big game players were Owen and Brian, from my experiences and from everyone's watching them. And like, you know, if you go through examples of finals and Heineken finals in 2011, the second half when guys need to step up, they were there, or Reds are for Wasps when they won it, or Reds are for Ireland when he got his chance against Australia in the World Cup in 2011, or Drico, you know, countless times throughout his career. But there are guys that do that and they just arrive on the big day and they've got the mentality for it. But one guy that sticks out in my head that I could never get my head around, but I was only kind of breaking into the team at the time, was Rocky Elsom. And because he'd be late to stretching sessions, he'd be late to, he literally sometimes he'd turn up halfway through a session, and because Michael Checken knew him from, like, if we did that in the academy at the time, we would have been told to go home and not come back. But Rocky was late to it during the week, and then at the weekend this guy would just transform himself into the most amazing player, and I still can't get my head around that mentality, but he's like an extreme example of it.
Yeah, great answer. All right, 5-3-1-6 of the text number. You having a good time? Yeah, that was good. Yeah, you're getting good at this. All right, we're live here from the best seat in the house at Drury Buildings, Dublin, with Vodafone, official sponsor of the Irish rugby team. We'll talk more rugby after these.
Get closer to Irish rugby with News Talk and Vodafone, official sponsor of the Irish rugby team.
All right, you're very welcome back. Our chief fluffer, Nathan Murphy, has disappeared there during the ad break and was supposed to help the crowd. Hello, everybody! We're live from the best seat in the house at Drury Buildings, Dublin, with Vodafone, official sponsor of the Irish rugby team. We've got Brian O'Driscoll, Fergus McFadden and Owen Redden with us. If anybody has any questions for us, you can stick your hand up and Nathan will actually bring them to air, or you can text us as well on 53106. Just in terms of that whole defensive structure that we were talking about beforehand, from an attacking perspective, what do we have that we can actually break down the defensive structures that these other teams are going to come up against us, Brian? Like, is it just chipping over and running and collecting? Like, what?
We've got a coach that is anal about his analysis. He has seen more games of rugby than I would think than any other coach in the world. He's obsessed by it. It's his passion as well. If there's any game that's ever been televised, you can be sure he's seen it.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine the work that goes on behind the scenes. You know, he does, you know, Redzer thinks he's doing well at 70-hour weeks. Joe does 100-hour weeks. It's incredible how much he knows their system and how he tweaks the core plays that we have to modify and modifies them to create space. And the great thing is there might be 7 or 8 plays that lots of teams have seen over the last 3 or 4 years, but just the smallest little change up pulls them into a false sense of security and then frees someone else up. So I think he's the master of that, and he'll have done huge homework on them, and you'll see some line breaks irrespective of the weather because of that analysis.
As in, he'll spot the defensive formation, and in the middle of the game, the players will have practiced so often when they see this to know to pull the trigger on it.
They'll contort the defence to do something, right. Or and someone off screen will be doing a role, a blocking role, or holding someone in, or deepening a ruck, or you'll see a scrum pivoting around to make sure that the tight five aren't able to get out and be part of the defensive line, and they'll put someone through the hole. Like if you actually pull back and analyse all of the tries Ireland have scored over the last 3-4 years. You know, a lot of them are to plan on what Joe Schmidt has analysed for.
Yeah, I agree with Rico. I think some of Joe's detail will definitely work in a few of the games, picking teams off in like the first two or three phases. But potentially against the likes of England and in the Aviva, they might not work. But what I do think will soften them up and potentially, hopefully, create tries for us is that I think with a couple of injuries that England have picked up, I think that we have some of the best ball, if we have the best ball carriers in the competition in our pack. I think you go through CJ Stander, Ian Henderson in the second row, Jack McGrath, Tadhg Furlong, Sean O'Brien, Eve Jamie Heaslip. Like, these are incredible ball carriers. Over their stats will be in and around all of them in and around 15. CJ Stander getting up to 25 in games of like getting over the gain line, you know. So that'll be huge for us. I think if they're firing, that'll hopefully soften up the line for us, and if our set piece is going well as well. I think we have players in the back line that have X factor. You've got Siebes on the wing, you've got Keith Earls on the other, Gary Ringrose, there's not many times he goes to deck with the ball. You know, he gets the ball away the whole time. That's huge in the Six Nations offload. So I just think we have weapons, and I genuinely think we have weapons to break down any team in this and to hopefully go all the way.
Oh, and it seems like attack is a little bit less complicated than defence. Is that?
No, because I think we described to you there what way the defence has gone now, and even though what we're saying is good and it makes it easier to defend, it is more predictable. Like, it's more predictable than it used to be. Okay, so a guy like Joe loves that, and it might have been why he didn't move to it quicker, you know, because he could see the pitfalls with it and the problems with it and how to break it down, because this team are going to do this no matter what we do, you know, and that is the negative, that there are going to be coaches out there who can pick it apart, you know. In some weeks you'll hear the Irish, you know, on the TV giving out about kicking or whatever. But like, most of those kicks would have been designed around, you know, scoring a try or, you know, just manipulating defence, as Brian said. So,
you're not saying the Six Nations punditry used to be bad. What?
Well, I think
exactly. What?
The Six Nations punditry is fine. It's just they give out about every other bit of rugby we play all year, no matter what we do, which I always found difficult. When I turn on the Premiership and I hear Brian telling us how great it is, and I actually agree with him, I just think that rather than the comparison was just that we were hearing people who we thought were being honest, even though we were going to win in hiding cups or as a country, listening to people telling people not to come back in after half time to watch a match, you know, on occasion in a Pro 12 is just crazy. And then you fast forward 10 years and who's getting all the money now, which is the Premiership, because they're the right package. You know, they have more people watching as well because of the population, but at the same time, you know, they had people who realised that the rugby was the product, you know, and that the presenters weren't the whole product.
Yeah.
Now, there are presenters who are product of themselves, but, like, the game's got to grow, you know, and unfortunately...
It can't be on the back of some personalities.
No, and unfortunately, you know, Six Nations grows anyway, because at least we don't have full monopoly on what everyone hears. We hear other coverage. Wales have an idea of how Ireland are playing. England can tell us we played well. We don't have to listen to someone in our country, because if we relied on that, I don't think you'd hear it often enough. And I think at Pro 12 level, that's the biggest problem. All we hear is Irish commentary on Irish teams, you know, and it's mainly people saying, I'm better than that, you know. And I think that's caused a problem. It's caused a problem now because, you know, the gap between the revenues that French, English and Irish clubs is bigger than it should be.
Yeah. Why aren't you working in rugby?
Because...
You like it. Like,
yeah,
you're
I do
obsessed.
Like it. Maybe the answer I just gave you.
Okay, fair point. Well, we can pick that up again sometime. The out-half situation is obviously, there's been a lot of conversation this week about whether or not Madigan is being treated fair. And we talked a little bit about it off air earlier to the people in the room. But the expectation is that Paddy Jackson is going to be able to perform. If Jackson gets injured, we are then at a situation where Ian Keatley, who wasn't in the match day 23 for the away trip to Racing for Munster recently, is going to be playing a fair significant portion of minutes in the Six Nations. So not an ideal scenario we find ourselves in.
No, it's not. You know, first of all, we've lost one of the best 10s in the world. You're going to be less off as a result. Paddy Jackson really stepped up to the plate in the summer when he got his opportunity down in South Africa, fitted in differently than Johnny. Johnny is kind of conducts the whole thing. Yeah. I think Paddy probably reacts as more of a facilitator to other players. But we're talking about Conor Murray and the targeting of him. I'm sure Scotland have said about targeting Paddy Jackson as well, because a lot of those players will have played against Ulster a lot and know that he's very proficient. I think there's more question marks around Ian Keatley and particularly his goal kicking.
Yeah.
And if you take that away from a team or throw it up to question in wet conditions on a tough day, you've got, as I said earlier, you've got to keep the scoreboard ticking over. And I wonder if Ian Keatley does come on, will we see Conor Murray goal kicking?
In the long run, you can see all the thinking behind not picking Madigan or putting him in the squad, and I think everybody kind of agrees with it. There is this kind of short-term need, or is there? Do you just have to stick to your guns and say that's the rules?
If you look at it, Ian Madigan's not playing for Bordeaux the whole time. If Ian Madigan is absolutely killing it then in Bordeaux, I think he gets in the squad. I think he's started okay, but it's been a bit of a mixed bag down there, and He obviously made his bed and now he has to sleep in it, because Joe picked Johnny when he was in Racing because he was the best 10 that Ireland had.
Yeah.
Ian Madigan didn't have that luxury because he's not the best 10 that Ireland have. And he's gone and taken that option, and he wanted to play to play 10 for a side. It's the reality that he finds himself in, that if you're not playing your best rugby as a backup 10, then you're not going to be selected.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of like JJ Hannon is not even in the conversation at the moment because he hasn't played properly for Northampton and didn't force his way into the squad. Is it kind of in players' minds when it comes up to contract times, like, I have a choice here, I can go away or I can play for Ireland?
Yeah, of course. And I think that was probably a really tough decision for Mads. He's such an ambitious guy, and obviously he'd gotten to the stage where he's playing second fiddle to Johnny for quite a while, and he wanted his first team rugby. But obviously you're sacrificing the test career. It is going to take a back seat. Like, realistically, there might be three players maybe that could go away from Ireland, play rugby and still get picked to come back. You're going to go away and that's going to be taken. So that's obviously happened to Mads, and I think a few things that have happened to Ian since he's gotten to Bordeaux between at times maybe not playing his best rugby and admit that himself, but also he had a bit of a groin problem that, like, people talking about him coming back, would he be in the best position himself to add? Maybe not. So, exactly. And we're thin on the ground at tens at the moment, but I think if we can get through this game away tomorrow in Murrayfield and come away with the win, as the lads said, the main thing is just the win. Johnny might be back next week and we could be in fine fettles.
It's fine. Tyler Bladendahl is due to qualify in a year's time, yeah. So we're all right.
But just on Mads as well, though, like, you got to step into his head, right? And there's nobody on the bench for Ireland thinking, I should be on the bench for Ireland. Like, they're thinking, I can go away, I can get better, I can challenge, I can start for Ireland, right? So he didn't feel like he could do that in Leinster, where, he could actually get ahead of Johnny, because he felt that Leinster, stay the same it was Johnny be playing, and he'd be trying to all of a sudden get out ahead of Johnny for Ireland without taking him on properly. So in fairness to him, he's gone away because he's thought, I'll improve as a player, I'll get better, and maybe even if I play well enough for Bordeaux, I might be in a position to challenge. But even at some point in my career, at least I'll have tried and gone after my goal. And I think that's the main reason why he went. I think to expect someone to stay and be a sub, largely is a lot, probably too much to ask, really.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a bunch of examples, you included, of players who go away and come back and are, like, vastly improved for that experience. Leo Cullen, There's a bunch of other ones who've done it as well. Shane Jennings too. So like clearly a bunch of Irish players going off to England and France and having a couple of years is really good for our rugby culture in the long run.
Yeah, it depends on how much game time they're getting at home. You know, like the other side of the coin, someone could argue against Madden's, they would hit loads of rugby game time here in Ireland, but he probably didn't get the premium games for Leinster that he wanted to get.
Yeah.
But I think whatever about having a debate about whether someone in Ian's situation should go or not, you know, if you're not playing at all, it is a much easier, an easier decision. You know, I think as a player and as a person, you need to give yourself a chance to go and do your work, see how good you can be, you know, and then hopefully, if it is abroad, you know, work your way back into an Irish province.
Jamie in Athlone wants to know, I saw Warren Gatland was in town earlier this week. Are players conscious in any way that their Six Nations performances could win them a spot on a Lions tour? I expect them to say no, it's one game at a time. But surely those thoughts sneak in?
I think the best way to think about Lions selection is you've way more of a chance if you win the Six Nations. If you go well as a collective,
yeah,
you're going to individually shine, or you're going to shine in a partnership. So there's no point. It's going to be far more difficult to be picked in a 50-50 call with someone else if you find yourself second last or finishing up third. If you're in the top two, it means you're playing the best rugby. It means you're most competitive. And so you're going to be in the shop window for Warren to pick you.
Yeah.
I think in 2009, like how many Irish players went? There was so many right through that team that went over there and toured. And that's the thing, you know, if you win the competition or you win the Grand Slam, the spine of your team is going to go. And I think the same thing happened at the following tour at Wales. And, you know, it's going to have a huge bearing. So as a collective, you do well with the team, then you've got more of a chance of going, as Brian said.
05 was a small bit different because everyone in all the teams went on tour to New Zealand.
Was that a good idea?
Not so much.
Question for Owen. Why was he in the dugout for Leinster in Montpellier in round two last October, 4 months after retiring?
Yeah, I was just...
on holidays?
Yeah, happened to be in the area. No, I just travelled with the team that weekend. It seemed like a nice circle finish.
Is this like going to Old Crescent? Or is that
yeah,
the same kind
well...
of, you're going to be there anyway.
I'd actually prefer to play at home than in Montpellier in the sea. After a minute, that winger ran through and was one-on-one with Luke McGrath with 40 yards behind him, and Luke tackled him, and I was thinking, no, I'm better off here. And so are Leinster.
Lads, give us your predictions, will you?
I think it'll be a very tight game, but I still fancy us. I think our pack has too much, so I think we'll win by 4 or 5.
And who's going to win the Six Nations?
I think we will. I don't think we'll win a Grand Slam, but I think we might just sneak it.
Okay, Ferg?
I think it's going to be a really tight game, not as expansive as people think tomorrow with the weather. But I think our pack is going to be too strong. I think we're going to win by around 10.
Okay.
And I think overall, I just think with a few of England's you know, key positions, the two Vunipola brothers are so huge for them. Rob Shaw is a leader. I think this could be our year, and I think we could do the Grand Slam if we get a bit of luck.
Ooh, he's gone there.
Yeah, I think.
Muted applause. They're too scared to clap that.
Yeah. I think it'll be tight tomorrow. Paddy O'Regan to kick a kick to win the game, maybe. And apart from that, I think I'm an Irish fan, so I'm going to say hopefully we can go all the way. You know, strangely, I kind of feel like tomorrow is almost, you know, this is. Tomorrow's a huge game. If you win that game, it sets us up really well. But it is so important and so unknown. New rules away in Scotland. It's going to be a tough day.
Yeah. All right, lads. Great stuff. Please give it up. All ready. Fergus McFadden and Brian O'Driscoll. We're obviously going to be covering that game in great detail on tomorrow's show as well. We're live from the best seat in the house here tonight at Drury Buildings, Dublin, with Vodafone, official sponsor of the Irish rugby team. We have some of our best stuff and Friday Night Racing coming up next. Stay tuned. Thanks, guys.
Off the Ball.
Home of Wednesday Night Rugby with Woody and Jerry.
On News Talk 106 to 108.